You found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to The Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard weekday mornings at 9 o'clock Pacific Time, right here on LATalkRadio.com, which is how you can listen live. We're on Channel 2, for clarification. And then later in the day, we post the podcast so you can download on demand. You can listen on demand. There are free apps so that you can pull it into your iPhones and your Androids and your tablets. And it's MariaSanchezShow.com, and the blog is TheMariaSanchezShow.com. We're live. It's Friday, June 7th. I hope your week went well. Thank you so much for joining us. We consider it an honor and a privilege with all the noise that's out there. And we try to focus as much on inspirational, kind of uplifting good news as possible. And the first thing this morning, I'm up at 5:30, and I'm, you know, pulling the news in and down. And I was like, there's not a whole lot. And then so we dug deeper, and we found some good stories. But a couple of our guests today are going to help us with that as well. Our first guest, he's been called the modern-day Napoleon Hill, which Napoleon Hill was one of the first in our world or our culture to highlight personal success stories. He was the author of Think and Grow Rich and The Law of Success, two of the seminal books that he wrote that help people. So our guest, our first guest this hour is going to be Doug Vermeeren, excuse me, Doug. He's going to be joining us in just a little bit. He has a film out called The Gratitude Experiment. He's a producer, director, and author, and he's one of the most sought-out public speakers. So it's great that he's taking the time to visit with us, because my personal mantra in that regard is an attitude of gratitude helps everything. And we're going to ask him some questions about gratitude, and he's investigated the lives of over 400 of the world's top achievers, and this is a documentary. And then later on in the program, we have the co-founder of an internet dating site that also has singles mixers that are a little bit offbeat and off kind of somewhat risque. She's going to be joining us, so that'll be fun. So in the interest of the news of the day, the New York Times editorial board, which twice endorsed President Obama, wrote a blistering editorial last night, and they published it, and then this morning, overnight, they amended the last line, but we won't go into the whole thing. But they said that the administration was using the same platitude it uses in every case of overreach, that, quote, terrorists are a real menace and you should just trust us. So it continues on to say, those reassurances have never been persuasive, whether on secret warrants to scoop up a news agency's phone records or secret orders to kill an American suspected of terrorism, especially coming from a president who once promised transparency and accountability. The administration has now lost all credibility. Then overnight, they amended that last line to say, the administration has now lost all credibility on this issue. So in terms of some good news, coffee drinkers, listen up. This is a study that is going to be published in the June 9th issue of the New York Times Magazine, and it's about cancer and coffee, and it's good news. The National Cancer Institute went over the health information of more than 400,000 volunteers ranging in age from 50 to 71. They were free of major diseases at the study's start, which was in 1995. Then in 2008, they followed up with those folks. By 2008, 50% of the participants had passed away. But men who reported drinking two or three cups of coffee a day were 10% less likely to have died than those who didn't drink coffee, and women drinking the same amount had 13% less risk of dying during the study. They're saying it's not exactly clear what coffee has to do with longevity, but it's a very strong correlation. So there have been other recent studies that have linked moderate coffee drinking, and they consider moderate 15 to 20 ounces of coffee a day that has specific advantage. This is another study, a reduction in the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, a reduction in the risk of developing basal cell carcinoma, which is the most common skin cancer, a reduction in the risk of prostate cancer, oral cancer, and breast cancer recurrence. So when I never drank coffee until I went to college, and then I started drinking it black from the dining commons, and I figured if you can drink black coffee from the dining commons, you can drink anything. And then when I was having babies, which I have four, I stayed away from caffeine, and then I nursed them all, so probably almost a decade doing that, even though I had four children in 5 years. So I've never really been a coffee person. I like the taste. I like the smell. I like the warmth, but I don't need the caffeine. In fact, there was a time when I was producing Mark and Kim here in Los Angeles on Coast 103.5. If I even had a Diet Coke in the morning, I would get, and I don't really care for that feeling. But starting this incarnation, which we're just closing in on our seventh week, thank you, it's been an honor and a privilege. I've started to have an occasional cup of coffee, and at first it was like, this is ridiculous, why am I doing this? To the point where now it has very little effect, and so I've brought myself back to it. So apparently it's a good thing. They say animal experiments have shown that caffeine can stave off dementia. And then a 2012 study of humans, they said they tested the blood levels of caffeine in older adults who had mild cognitive impairment, which is the first part of serious forgetfulness, and it's a common precursor to Alzheimer's disease. So then they reevaluated these same adults 2 to 4 years later. And those in the studies with little or no caffeine circulating in their bloodstreams were far more likely to have progressed into full-blown Alzheimer's than those whose blood indicated that they had about 3 cups worth of coffee. So again, the 15 to 20 ounces seems to be the number. So if you do something wrong, you don't want to be in Bolivia, because it was reported that the 17-year-old in this town outside of La Paz, Bolivia, had been identified by police as the possible culprit in the attack on a 35-year-old woman who he raped and killed. So on Wednesday, they had her funeral. 200 people grabbed him, the 17-year-old Santos Ramos, and buried him alive alongside his alleged victim Wednesday night. They said that he had been tied up. They grabbed him. They threw him into the open grave. They put the women's coffin in it, and they filled the grave with earth. On Thursday, they blocked the road to their town, which prevented police and prosecutors from reaching it. And you want to talk about a new definition of vigilante justice? This morning, we've talked about the Pope Francis. Probably he's on my radar because I'm a Catholic, but he has a mass every morning, and he makes off-the-cuff comments, and one of them that made news was that he says atheists are good people too, and they can go to heaven. It's all about being good. Well, this morning, he met with thousands of children from Jesuit schools across Italy and Albania, and he answered their questions. And they said, answering their questions one by one, Pope Francis told them the decision to become a priest had been difficult for him, and that he had suffered moments of interior darkness when you feel dry without interior joy. But he said he went ahead because he loved Christ. And then this little girl, Teresa, a bright-eyed redhead, no more than 6-year-old, asked the Pope flat out if he had wanted to be Pope, and after joking around, he replied, "No, I didn't want to be Pope." And then finally, here in Los Angeles, begins a celebration of the mayor's career. On the steps of City Hall at Grant Park in downtown Los Angeles between 5 and 10 p.m. Pacific tonight, Friday. It's called Celebrate LA, during which everybody's invited to say goodbye to Mayor Villaraigosa and hear addresses from President Bill Clinton and Mayor-elect Eric Garcetti. And we've got President Obama coming to Southern California any moment now also. The event will also feature appearances and performances by Placido Domingo, Pepe Aguilar, Wanda Sykes, Ryan Seacrest, Sevilla De Prima, and others. And the city is absorbing the $75,000 in costs, and also corporations, Wells Fargo, Disney, and Time Warner will help defray the costs. And now we are going to speak with our first guest, and he, again, is the creator of the documentary The Gratitude Experiment, Douglas Vermeeren. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Doug. Good morning. It's Maria Sanchez. You're live on the program. Thank you for taking the time to join us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Doug, before we get into the specifics of The Gratitude Experiment, your new documentary, tell us about your career. They're comparing you to the modern-day Napoleon Hill, which is quite the compliment. And I'm. And if folks aren't familiar, I gave a little background about Napoleon Hill, what he published in the personal success literature. And even the Napoleon Hill Foundation, their mission is to make the world a better place in which to live. So that's a heady company for you to be compared with. So how did your career begin, Doug?
Well, basically, you know, it's kind of funny because I began at the beginning of my career became rich. And as you know, Napoleon Hill conducted research into the lives of more than 400 of the world's top achievers. In his day, it was mostly innovators, inventors, people Ford, Tom Edison, the Rockefellers,
you know,
Andrew
what?
Carnegie.
I'm going to call you back, Doug, because we've got a bad connection, because I've spoken to him twice this morning and there was no problem. So we'll do it again, because he was cutting out for me, so I can only imagine that he's cutting out for you. He's in Canada. Not that that matters. We spoke with a young man from the Ukraine yesterday, so.
Hi there. You've reached Doug Vermeeren, and I'm not able to take your call right now. If you could, leave me.
We'll call him again. It's live radio. I call it raw radio. We'll get it. So the Gratitude Experiment is premiering in many of our world's biggest.
Hello.
Hi. Well, I had to call you back because the connection was bad. Thank you.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah.
That's okay.
So, you know, Napoleon Hill did all this research into 400 of the world's top achievers. Primarily, he studied innovators and inventors. And so when I read that book, I decided, in addition to, you know, just applying the principles inside, I actually wanted to form a relationship with 400 of the world's top achievers and learn directly from them. So I went out and I began to study, you know, the world's top achievers wherever I could find them. But I included some different things in my criteria than Napoleon did. Napoleon, of course, in his day, certain industries didn't exist. For example, technology or, you know, multinational corporations, network marketing, all these things didn't exist in Napoleon Hill's day. But in ours, they did. So I included them in our studies. The other thing that I did that was very different is Napoleon Hill, in his day, celebrities and athletes weren't making the kind of money that they do nowadays, too. And so I included also celebrities and athletes within my study of the successful achievers. And I found some startling things that, you know, obviously validated a lot of what Napoleon Hill found. But I also found a lot of things from a psychological or neuroscience, brain science point of view that, you know, he really just didn't have access to study at that time. So I found some things that went even far deeper than what Napoleon did.
And when you say achiever, how did you define that? I mean, success is relative, so.
Of course it is. Yeah, absolutely. I really began by looking at people's net worth at first to determine what that was, and then I also looked at their accomplishments. And so this included people, for example, the founders of FedEx, Nike, Reebok, the Aveda Group, Christian Dior, Jordache Jeans, Fruit of the Loom. And then, of course, you know, some of these athletes were award-winning professional athletes, people who were Olympians, gold medal Olympians. I also found, you know, among some of my celebrities, those that had won Academy Awards. You know, I really looked for people who had just excelled, who had done extraordinary things. And it wasn't always financial, but yes, it did start out that way. I was looking at the financial success to start with. But the more that I dug into it, the more I found, just like what you said, is that, you know, success is such an odd thing. We can't define it very easily. And so, you know, I really kind of tried to level it out with five pillars of what I call success. And that's how you feel about your abundance, your relationships, your health, yourself, and your spirituality. And so I tried to find experts in each of those categories that I could learn from.
Could you repeat those five, please? The five
pillars?
Yeah,
absolutely. Abundance, mm-hmm. relationships, health, self, and spirituality. And of course, one is not more important than the other. They all need to be balanced in order for a person to be successful. And by the way, it's not a specific level of success they need to attain. It's your feelings about it. For example, there was an individual that was in my success interviews that was, terminally ill. And he felt marvelous about his health, but it wasn't getting any better. And so it really is how you feel about these things that determines your success. And if you want to know quickly where you're unfulfilled, just take a look at what your major goals are right now. You know, if you're on the verge of a divorce, well, it might be that, you know, your relationship area is highly lacking. If you're, you know, financially in a desperate situation, well, obviously that's the area that you're most focused on for the time being and so forth. And so success, in my opinion, is really finding a balance between those five pillars. If you can be fulfilled and find balance in those pillars, then, in my opinion, you're a success.
And did you meet with these folks or speak with them over the phone or Skype or?
I did meet with all of them. And, in fact, I also have a relationship ongoing with many of them. So even in my coaching program, Maximum Results, I do bring many of these experts in on a regular basis. They do still share all their insights and advice with me. And what was interesting is as I explained to them what my mission was, you know, I was trying to find these, you know, tools for success, the systems to create more success. Many of them, in fact, said, well, be sure to come back and tell me also what you find. And so many of them have even become students, and there's several celebrities that I'm involved in coaching even right now.
So did you go to find out how people are successful and then found those five pillars, or did you already ascribe to the five-pillar philosophy and then learn that that also somehow organically integrated with the folks that you met with?
Well, that's a great question. I would have to say that at the beginning, like I said, my definition of success really was primarily focused on the financial aspect. As I began my interviews with the successful people and started to look at these, I noticed that in some respects they may be very successful financially, but there were other things that were lacking. Mm-hmm. And so those also soon became criteria for success. And then, of course, through, you know, my research and interaction with them, I found and developed these five pillars. Naturally, as I've gone through, you know, modern psychology and, you know, ancient philosophy, I've always found now that these five pillars have been consistently validated as five things that we all need as humans and we all crave as humans. And so, it did evolve organically, but it's been validated, you know, by external sources beyond myself, right?
And the gratitude experiment, was that your mission to make a documentary, or then did that come as a result subsequently to these meetings?
Well, the gratitude experiment is actually my second movie. My first one, The Opus, mm-hmm. actually follows how to take a vision of what you would like, turn it into a workable plan, and ultimately ongoing performance in your life. In that film, I had several people from The Secret and other personal development movements. For example, Jack Canfield, Mark Victor Hansen's in there, Joe Vitale, John DeMartini, Marcy Shimoff, Morris Goodman. That whole gang was in my first movie. And it was wonderful. In fact, we've really received a really great reception. It's now in 22 languages worldwide. Random House has taken it out as a book. It's done very well for us. And so kind of the way that the gratitude experiment came about is actually I was meeting with a friend of mine who was a university professor in psychology and neuroscience. And as I was talking with her, I asked her just point blank, you know, the law of attraction is getting a lot of exposure in the media nowadays. What are your thoughts on it as a scientist? You know, is the law of attraction legit? Like, what are your thoughts? And she said something very interesting. She said, well, there's no disputing that it really can help provide a positive influence for people and create positive results, but it's not a law. And I said, excuse me, you know, here you've got all these people on television talking about it and all this stuff going on, you know, that people are saying it's a law. So help me understand what you mean. And she said that basically for it to be a scientific law, it needs to have quantifiable variables that can be repeated exactly in the same way for everyone and achieve the same result, much like the law of gravity. Mm-hmm. And so that really kind of piqued in me an interest. Okay, well, if the law of attraction isn't really, you know, if we're missing scientific data to demonstrate this, what about another principle that we know makes a difference? For example, gratitude. And so I began to go out and study gratitude and just really notice, if I could, is there a difference that it makes, and can that difference really be quantified? Can we see what it looks like? And then naturally, can we start to sort of systematize it so that everyone can learn how to practice gratitude and get some positive results from it? And so that was really the beginning, the genesis of the film, if you will.
And to backtrack, the law of attraction is about like attracting like, correct?
Yes.
That's the basic premise of it. But what you just said is that it may not happen every single time, like gravity, which is a great example. So what I have heard early on, I interviewed a man who was more than a life coach years ago, and he was talking about your mental health in terms of your attitude and demeanor and happiness and that sort of thing. And what he said then, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about this, he said that gratitude and stress are physically impossible to coexist within our senses. So that if you find yourself being stressed out, if you default to what are you grateful for, you will find that you do not experience stress.
Oh, yeah, I think he's bang on. That's definitely true. You know, gratitude, even just from a scientific point of view, changes the way that our brainwaves are. And for us to, you know, when we're under stress, our brainwaves become very chaotic. Our behavior also becomes just as chaotic, and we lose our ability to problem solve in an effective way. When we are in a state of gratitude, we begin to recognize things differently. We see things differently. Opportunities appear differently. And so our whole capacity to implement strategies to solve problems are better. In fact, I kind of look at it this way, that when you're, you know, in a difficult moment and, you know, tragedies all around you, gratitude really is the only thing that can kind of paint a way to escape. It can give you that pathway to recognize. But of course, if we're preoccupied, it's kind of like if someone's, you know, gotten to the end of the rope and they're hanging on for dear life, your focus is on hanging on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you now recognize that you've got ample rope beneath you and you've got options to explore and you're grateful for what is positive and expanding, well, all of a sudden you look at things a little bit differently. You're not in survival mode. You're now in, well, for lack of a better way, you're in survival mode, like to thrive, right? Like, what can I do now to make this even better and bigger? We can think more clearly at these things. So, yeah, I'd agree with him. Bang on.
So is it about being pessimistic and optimistic? I mean, what makes somebody grateful and somebody not? I have personal experience. My first husband's mother, she was in a downward spiral. And there was nothing that I could say. I remember they moved, and it was because they had to downsize, and it wasn't a choice they made. It was something that they had to do. So when we got to from their home to their townhome, I was like, oh, you must be so happy. And she looked at me like, why would I be happy? And I was like, well, at least you have a roof over your head, and at least you were able to buy something small. You know, so I don't know. Are you innately grateful, or can you become grateful?
Gratitude is something that does need to be cultivated and nurtured. And by the way, just to this idea of optimistic and pessimistic, or positive thinking and negative thinking, there was a Harvard study that actually demonstrated there's more to this than just the two choices. In fact, it's been reasoned that we have actually four places where our thoughts either go. And that's negative thinking, neutral thinking, which is where we spend most of our time, then positive thinking, which generally requires a negative situation for us to react to. For example, you missed the bus, you lost your job, you all of a sudden positive think to try and find what's the silver lining, right? And then, of course, the last kind of thinking is empowered thinking, where we actually make a conscious decision ahead of time how we will, you know, proceed, what we will do to actually create the situations that we want. So I think gratitude, you know, if we're looking, you know, at someone like your ex-mother-in-law, it's also a choice. And if she decides ahead of time that she's not going to be happy when she arrives at wherever she's going to arrive, it doesn't really matter what the external circumstances are. She's already sort of decided internally what things are going to look like. Now, of course, I don't want to come across as criticizing that individual, but one of the things that's very interesting in our studies of gratitude is the very strongest thing to destroy gratitude, to take it out, is a sense of entitlement. So when a person feels like they are, you know, when they take things for granted rather than take things as gifts, all of a sudden they become ungrateful. And that can also grow. In the same way that whatever you're grateful for expands, also whatever you're ungrateful for will also expand. And if you choose to see the world as owing you something every time, or not good enough, or not meeting your standard, you'll continually look for evidence to support that belief, right?
And Doug, how do you distinguish ungrateful from ungrateful?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's, you know, ungrateful, I think, really comes from what we choose to remember. You know, if we're ungrateful, you know, we don't really remember that someone's done something for us, or that we received, or that we've been able to have that come into our life. And ingratitude, I think, actually is more just like a, you know, a virtue, if you will, that's just a way of being.
Would you say, you know, arrogant?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. In fact, any of these attributes like arrogance or selfishness or, you know, manipulation or control, or all come from a place of ingratitude, right? We're taking things for granted, like someone owes us something.
You know what I am noticing about how you phrase things is that you're making these, what we could call emotions, active choices.
Absolutely they are.
Because some people think that life just, you know, happens, but you're, the way you speak, it's about, no, you're helping to make it happen because you're choosing this path or that choice or this decision or whatever, which is fairly empowering.
Well, all responses that we make are within our power. We get to choose. Now, it is a fact that, you know, through our ritual tendencies, the things that we've chosen over time, you know, we do have these trigger responses with us. In fact, our brain's mission to keep us safe is to find a solution to any challenge or question or you know, stimulus as quickly as possible. So many times we do have that challenge of falling into the trap of making the same choices, feeling the same emotions and the same responses that we always do. But the moment that we are aware and we make a conscious decision to change, we can start making that happen. Now, keeping in mind, I'm not saying that it's easy and I'm not saying that it's quick. I don't agree with a lot of the, you know, gurus of today that say change can happen instantly after a 5-minute seminar or a day or whatever. It's kind of like ice melting in your hand. You've got to hang on to it. It's very uncomfortable and it takes time. But if you're committed and you're focused on the real changes that you want to create and, you know, you consistently put in the effort, you can do it. I liken this analogy, if you will, to like jumping into a cold, cold swimming pool as well. Many people say the first step is the hardest to take to get into the pool. I don't agree with that. I think many of us decide every day we want to take the first step. We're going to make a change. We're going to do things different. Where it's hardest, same thing with the cold swimming pool, it's staying in the pool. Most people don't want to stay in there very long when it's cold. And it's the same with changes in our life. It's the same with getting to success. You've got to get committed, you've got to stay focused, and you've got to stick with the program. And a lot of times that can be difficult because we don't always know what to expect. We don't always recognize that there's going to be difficult moments, and we don't always, you know, have a plan when we encounter other humans that maybe are not, you know, conducive to what we're looking to accomplish. And so we've really got to be focused and committed and make a direct plan to make that happen in order to be successful.
Well, and since there isn't a roadmap, we don't necessarily know. We're in uncharted territories for ourselves, and it's like, and it does feel uncomfortable, as you mentioned, but you have to commit to see it through, the irony of which is that we usually don't make changes unless we've experienced some kind of rejection or loss or failure.
Yeah, oftentimes that's what it takes. Now, it's interesting you said that there's not a roadmap, and it's interesting that after having done these interviews now with 400 of the world's top achievers, you're right, there's not a clear roadmap, but there's definitely signs along the way that will tell you where you need to go and what you need to do. I kind of like what the Chinese philosopher Confucius said one time. He said there's three ways to learn wisdom. The first is reflection. There's a danger with that, though. If you've never, for example, made over $1 million a year, I don't care how much you reflect, you're going to have a hard time coming up with ideas that will get you there. I mean, you may have good business ideas, but you won't have everything figured out. The second thing that Confucius said is experience is the way that we learn wisdom. And that's true, but it can take a lot of time. For example, Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers said that it takes approximately 10,000 hours to become an expert in any given thing. Well, most of us don't have that kind of time when it comes to experience. Most of us, if we follow that route, we die with our music still in us. But the last thing Confucius said, yeah, I think what Confucius said here on the last thing, I think, is the most essential for us to look at, and he said it's imitation. We find someone who is doing what we would like to do, and then we imitate it. And the more closely we can imitate it, the more likely and the more probable it is that we will have success also. Now, I would add one other thing to what Confucius said, and I think that we also need to innovate on it when we see it, because it's not enough just to imitate someone else. We need to make it personal, and we need to make it relevant. You know, so we are doing, you know, what fits best to our, you know, our current circumstances, also to the marketplace, to the day and age in which we live. There's so many things that we need to do to make it personal. So success, in other words, is not just a matter of thinking outside the box. It's a matter of finding a box to think in that matches closely to what we would like to do and then personalize it the very best we can. And that's, in my opinion, the closest that you're going to get to a roadmap.
Which is why they say that if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life, because you, it's not work to you. It's something that comes organically, that brings you joy and that you're good at.
Well, yeah, and that's true. But here's the other thing with that is, you know, I had a meeting with one of our top achievers not too long ago, and I asked him at lunch, what is the key to success? And he was telling me, you know, some people say it's picking something you don't like to do and then pushing through it. Mm. He said that's not true. He said success to him has always been find what you love, like what you just said, find what you love, and then do it even when you don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. Because the truth of the matter is there are going to be difficult days. I don't care, you know, if you've got the perfect job and everything is exactly how you want it, there's going to be days that it's still going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. So what do you do in those moments? Those are the moments that you've got to just, you know, you've got to get up, get out of bed, get going, and make it happen, even though today it's not the easiest day.
Which,
right?
Goes back to your example of the cold water in the pool. It's about commitment.
100% it is. Absolutely. In fact, you know, it's interesting that a person who is committed to an idea that they love is always going to be far more successful than someone who's forced into doing something brilliant. You just can't do it, right?
Right.
You know, and if you truly love it, here's the interesting thing is I was reading the other day the definition of courage. And there is a Chinese philosopher, again, I love Chinese philosophy. I think these guys really have some things figured out. But Tao Te Ching actually said that love brings forth bravery. So if you love something enough to do it, if you really are passionate about what you're doing, you'll find the courage to stick with it. You know, it's like a mother who jumps in front of a vehicle to protect her child.
Mm-hmm.
There's no cost too high for her to do that. She'll do whatever it takes to protect that child. So the question I have, if you're looking to get to success, you know, how much do you love that end result? How much do you love what you're trying to create? Because if you truly do, you're going to do whatever it takes to create that success. And you know what? You'll know soon enough whether you love it or not by really how much effort and time you're willing to invest to make it happen.
And this, the gratitude experiment, is it in wide release, or how do we avail ourselves of it?
Yeah, you can actually see it online right now at our website, thegratitudeexperiment.com. And then we are doing a variety of screenings across the country, and I know of many coaches and yoga studios that are bringing it in to do screenings in their area. But if you aren't able to locate one of those, the quickest way to see it is thegratitudeexperiment.com, the website. And naturally, if you want to host a screening, anybody out there listening, we're happy to support you in doing that too. We've got some really cool materials that we share with people screening it, and sometimes we even have some of our speakers come out. And by the way, I should mention who's in the film. You've got people like Bob Proctor, Mary Morrissey, Marie Diamond, who is in The Secret, John Gray, John DeMartini from The Secret, Lori Davis, Lisa Ryan, Dr. Joe Rubino, and myself. So you've got a really, really group, a sharp group of people that are, you know, sharing some really incredible insights into gratitude.
Doug Vermeer, thank you for your time, and I'm going to be speaking with your people about hosting one of those screenings. That's right down our alley.
Oh, we'd love to support you.
Okay, excellent. So we'll take that conversation offline. I cannot thank you enough for your time this morning. We try to present as much inspirational, motivational, feel-good kind of topics and stories and guests, and you fit exactly into that mission of ours. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, I look forward to speaking with you again. It's been fun.
Me too. Thank you. Have a great day and a fabulous weekend, Doug.
You too. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. And we will post, of course, this podcast later on mariasanchezshow.com and themariasanchezshow.com. And we will pursue hosting a screening, because how fun would that be? Because I was taking copious notes while I was speaking with him, because he just had such pearls of wisdom. He's internationally known, so that was really cool that he took the time. Now, to switch gears to something fun and light, we're going to be speaking with the co-founder, Amber Saletti, of On Speed Dating. And she's going to chat with us about what her website is about and the events that she has. And they're looking to expand. They're in New York at the moment, but to expand throughout the United States. So doing something you love.
Hey, Maria.
Amber, good morning, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So on speed dating, tell us how it came about, and you as the co-founder probably knows better than most.
Yeah, actually I was living in New York, living the single life like many women do, and I had gone to a lot of singles events that were only based on age range, and I found them to be very disappointing. I went with a friend of mine who ended up co-founding the company with me. It was a speed dating event, and it was for singles 25 to 35, and I'm 5'10", so, you know, I prefer taller men, and, you know, everyone that was at the event was within my age range, but they were all, like, 5'8 and shorter. You know, the first guy I sat with, it was an 8-minute date, which I think is way too long. And the first thing he said to me was, "I know you. You're on Match.com. I emailed you 10 times and you never responded to me. I paid my $40 and now you have to talk to me for 8 minutes. So I was like, oh my God, if this is what, you know, singles events and speed dating are about, we could definitely raise the bar. And then that's when me and my business partner got the idea to do our own singles events. We were both single, and we decided to subsidize our incomes and our dating lives and host events where we selfishly would be interested in the people attending. So the first event I did was a Size Matters night for women that want to date men 6'1 and taller. And I don't know, I'm sure a lot of your audience does online dating, and one of the big things is, you know, men are always rounding up their height mm-hmm. in their profiles mm-hmm. and women rounding down their weight. Mm-hmm. So at this event, to kind of deter that from happening, we measure the men to confirm that they are actually 6'1 or taller and not 5'10 and rounding up. Mm-hmm. And my partner liked teachers. We did like a hot for teacher event and a nurse Betty night and a gentleman prefer blondes night. And it just really took off to the point where almost 5 years later, we offer over 75 themed events and are probably one of the top dating services in New York.
Wow, and what fun, because you're right. I've been to one speed dating event. I interviewed a gal who was, this was many years ago, and it was just kind of starting. And mm-hmm. there, it was an age criteria, and that was the only thing that you had going for you, was that, yes, you there was a male and a female, and you happened to be in the same demographic, which doesn't prove to have anything to do with success, I would think. Now that you're mentioning it, it's like, yeah, duh. So talk about a niche that you've filled. So you made the news this week with your press release about your larger-than-life speed dating event, which is going to be next month. So talk about that, and then we'll go into the other ones that you've hosted so that people can get a flavor.
Yeah, I mean, again, we do over 75 themed events for singles of all sexual orientations. I mean, we have pretty much everything that you can imagine. Men with accents are hot. We have childproof for singles that don't want kids ever. We have Asian persuasion night. I mean, pretty much everything. And next month, we're going to be hosting an event that the ladies, it's kind of for the ladies, it's called Hung Speed Dating. So it's for women that are kind of in search of a man with a big package, if you will, well-endowed men. And, you know, in doing research, it says that the average size for men, if you will, is around 5.3 inches. So for this specific Hung speed dating event, men have to be at least 7 inches or bigger to attend. And, you know, I always preface to the men, you would think more women would be signing up for this event theme than men, but that's not the case. We turn away hundreds of men for this event. There's a wait list for men right now. And I really think it comes down to being an ego thing for the men. They just want to be at this event because it's, you know, they're proud of their manhood. But yeah, women sign up as well. And I always preface to the men, you know, just because you're coming to this event where women, you know, are signing up to meet guys with, you know, big packages, it doesn't mean you're getting laid tonight. It's just really more of a peace of mind thing for the women. I'm sure so many women out there have experienced it where they're dating someone and, you know, things are going well, and then it comes to that moment where they take the relationship to the bedroom, and there's sometimes, you know, disappointment or, like, kind of a big shock that's even traumatic. I've heard some of my girlfriends talk about. But this event is really just, you know, giving women the peace of mind that if they do, you know, hit it off with someone at the event and want to take it there, you know, they don't have to worry.
Do you measure the men?
You know what? The men would like for us to measure them, but we would have to charge extra for that. No, we don't measure the men. And it's funny because guys are sending in photos and, you know, at the event when they check in, they're often asking, so where are we going to do the measuring? Or they'll even just start to whip it out. And, you know, it's kind of based on the honor system. I mean, at the end of the day, how do we even know these, quote, singles attending the events are singles? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's somewhat of an honor system around that. But I do preface to all the women in attendance that if they ever do find out that any of the men at the event don't measure up, that they should let us know immediately, and they will be banned from all future Hung events.
Now, to get personal, we're speaking not just about the package, but the length of the penis.
And exactly. The package, the length of the penis, whatever you want to call it. Exactly, yes.
Does it matter if it's flaccid or erect in terms of the measurement?
We're talking erect size.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that does us no good as women if it's flaccid. I don't care if it's 10 inches in flaccid, you know?
So, Amber, how does it, you limit, obviously, to the gender, right, in terms of numbers, so that you've got an equal amount?
Yeah, with speed dating, it's fantastic. I mean, I think there's a real shift, again, happening in the dating world where, you know, it was really focused on online dating, but given how many inactive profiles are out there and how much fraud, you know, with the whole catfishing stuff happening, people are moving more towards offline dating, which are events like mine. And, you know, with speed dating, it's fantastic because you get to meet 10 to 20 singles in one evening. You know, the dates are painless because we only do 3-minute dates.
Oh, wow.
You get to meet each person for 3 minutes, which doesn't seem like a lot of time, but I rather leave daters wanting more than wanting to slit their wrists because, you know, 8 minutes, 10 minutes, it can be painful with some people. So basically everyone meets everyone at our events, and they have a dating pamphlet so that they can keep notes on who they're meeting, because there may be 5 Marias or six Johns at an event. And then what's nice is, you know, they go back to the privacy of their home and they log into the website on speeddating.com, and they're able to have visibility to everyone that attended the event, both genders. Because a lot of times, you know, I always encourage people to keep an open mind when going to a singles event, because it's not always about meeting the one. I mean, a lot of single women out there end up hitting it off with other women and find a new wing woman to go out with, you know? So we make it so you have visibility to everyone, so that if there's someone you're interested in either platonically or for a relationship, you select them as a match and they have visibility to your contact information.
Now,
and that's basically how it works.
Does age factor in? Because these are about proclivities or fetishes or preferences, but if you've got a 25-year-old man and a 45-year-old woman, that might not work.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why we're so different. I mean, we really do make it more about the interest, the common background, rather than the age. We have a very broad age range for the majority of our events. I think it's usually between 25 and 45. And, you know, we also do host a couple of events that are specific to age range to give those people that, you know, are more focused on that element an option as well. So we, you know, have an event for 20-somethings, 30-somethings, 40-somethings. We don't do those as often, but we do do those. But, you know, from what I've seen at our events, we have a much higher match and connection rate than most other services that are, you know, primarily doing their events based on age range. Because we all have our dating deal breakers, you know, and, you know, we know what's important to us. And, for example, my childproof event, if you don't want kids ever, then, you know, it's important that you meet someone that shares that common view. I mean, how many marriages is that broken up later down the road?
Do you have a way of tracking your success stories?
You know what? We don't. I mean, we do have a reporting system that shows us how many people select matches at events. So that's a good indicator to us of was it a successful event or not. Quite often, we'll have people write in to us and say, you know, hey, I met someone at your last event. We've been dating for a few months. It's going great. Or even, you know, I went to your Size Matters event a year ago, and, you know, on the day I went, I've now been proposed to by a guy that I met there. So we definitely hear a lot of stuff, but I'm sure there's a lot more we're not hearing about.
I would think so. It would be interesting to track, because it seems like you've really hit upon something here that is, forget the male-female thing.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery, and we really were the first to start introducing these super niche-themed events. And since then, I mean, you've seen a shift in the world of dating. I mean, now a lot of companies are also trying to offer, you know, super niche events, although, you know, not even close to the scale we do. And what's great is, you know, I kind of started this company with my partner to subsidize my income and also find myself a man, because I'd been living the single life for quite some time in New York. And, you know, I'm happy to say that I met someone a year and a half ago that we're still together and living together, and I'm now my own testimonial.
Yay. Do you do gay events?
Yeah, we do gay events. We do lesbian events. Some of our popular gay themes include Gay Jock Night. We do an Asian Persuasion Night for the gays. We do a Hot or Not Night, which is very popular with the gays, where men have to submit a photo and be pre-approved to attend. So it's kind of a more quality-controlled event, kind of know-before-you-go event.
Did you call that Hotter Night?
Hot or Not.
Oh, Hot or Not. So you,
yes,
you take only the hots?
We take only the hots.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we have a panel of three people that evaluate the photos, and we rotate that panel every event so that, you know, because people appreciate different things, so we want to mix it up.
And how do you get the word out?
I mean, we have a current membership list of close to 30,000 in the New York area.
Wow.
And, you know, just because what we do is so different and unique, we get a lot of word of mouth, people telling their friends, and a lot of press. So we typically find that people come to us. We've never really invested in advertising.
And Amber, you are now in New York, but you earlier suggested that you might be going to other cities in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, we've been very successful in one of the toughest markets for dating. There's a lot of competition in New York, and, you know, our model works very well. And, you know, with all the exposure we've gotten on the national level, we have people writing and calling daily asking, when are you going to have events here? When are you going to have events in my city? So, you know, we're looking to expand to other cities, and including L.A. and Austin and Chicago, some of the majors.
And any of the other 75 event, theme events that you have that might be unusual that you haven't mentioned? Because 75 is
a lot.
Well,
I think it's always interesting to see what men are signing up for mm-hmm. versus women.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask any other owner of a dating company, they'll tell you that their clientele is primarily women and that they really struggle to get men to fill their events. For us, it really depends on the theme. Some event themes were turning away men, like I mentioned, with Hung. But the most popular themes that we have with women include our Fireman Speed Dating event. I mean, that by far is super popular with women. We always are turning women away. We have a Men with Accents Are Hot event that is very popular with women. We have a Financista event, which is basically women that want to date men that work in the financial services field. Those are really popular with women, as well as our Size Matters Night. A lot of women out there are looking for tall men. And then with our men, the most popular events are Asian Persuasion Night, so men that want to date Asian women, very popular. Our Hot for Teacher event, our Hot or Not event, and we have a Stacked event, which is for what I like to call breast of intentioned men that are looking for busty women. That is super popular with the men, as is our Bionic Woman Night. So guys that want to date bisexual women, very popular with
oh,
the men.
I would think bionic meant fit, taut, you know, triathlete kind of thing. No.
Oh, not in this context, no.
Okay. Amber, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great way to kick off a Friday. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. And I would love to encourage any of your audience that is in the New York area to come check out one of our events, as well as singles living in other areas in the country, to sign up for our wait list as we're building our mailing list as we get ready to enter these markets. And they can register at our website, onspeeddating.com, with the promo code Maria Sanchez Show and save 50% off their first event with us.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And we'll post that also when we post the podcast.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Amber, terrific talking with you, co-founder of On Speed Dating. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a fabulous day and a tremendous weekend.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.